opposite was bound to take place, namely the resurgence of the German people, once militarism had been crushed. Did not these self-same circles sing the praises of the Entente, and did they not also lay the whole blame for the sanguinary struggle on the shoulders of Germany? Without this explanation, would they have been able to put forward the theory that a military defeat would have no political consequences for the German people? Was not the whole revolution dressed up in gala colours as blocking the victorious advance of the German banners, and that thus the German people would be assured its liberty both at home and abroad? Is that not so, you miserable lying rascals? That kind of impudence, which is typical of the Jews, was necessary in order to proclaim the defeat of the army as the cause of the German collapse. Indeed, the Berlin Vorwärts, that organ and mouthpiece of sedition, then wrote on this occasion that the German nation should not be permitted to bring home its banners triumphantly. And yet they attribute our collapse to the military defeat. Of course, it would be out of the question to enter into an argument with these liars, who deny at one moment what they said the moment before. I should waste no further words on them, were it not for the fact that there are many thoughtless people who repeat all this in parrot fashion, without being necessarily inspired by any evil motives. But the observations I am making here are also meant for our fighting followers, seeing that nowadays one's spoken words are often forgotten and twisted in their meaning. The assertion that the loss of the war was the cause of the German collapse can best be answered as follows. It is, admittedly, a fact that the loss of the war was of tragic importance for the future of our country. But that loss was not in itself a cause. It was rather the consequence of other causes. That a disastrous ending to this life-or-death conflict must have involved catastrophes in its train was clearly seen by everyone of insight who could think in a straightforward manner. But unfortunately, there were also people whose powers of understanding seemed to fail them at that critical moment. And there were other people who had first questioned that truth and then altogether denied it. And there were people who, after their secret desire had been fulfilled, were suddenly faced with the subsequent facts that resulted from their own collaboration. Such people are responsible for the collapse, and not the lost war, though they now want to attribute everything to this. As a matter of fact, the loss of the war was a result of their activities, and not the result of bad leadership, as they would now like to maintain. Our enemies were not cowards. They also know how to die. From the very first day of the war, they outnumbered the German army, and the arsenals and armament factories of the whole world were at their disposal for the replenishment of military equipment. Indeed, it is universally admitted that the German victories, which had been steadily won during 4 years of warfare against the whole world, were due to superior leadership, apart, of course, from the heroism of the troops. And the organization was solely due to the German military leadership. That organization and leadership of the German army was the most mighty thing that the world has ever seen. Any shortcomings which became evident were humanly unavoidable. The collapse of that army was not the cause of our present distress. It was itself the consequence of other faults. But this consequence in its turn ushered in a further collapse, which was more visible. That such was actually the case can be shown as follows. Must a military defeat necessarily lead to such a complete overthrow of the state and nation? Whenever has this been the result of an unlucky war? As a matter of fact, are nations ever ruined by a lost war, and by that alone? The answer to this question can be briefly stated by referring to the fact that military defeats are the result of internal decay, cowardice, want of character, and are a retribution for such things. If such were not the causes, then a military defeat would lead to a national resurgence and bring the nation to a higher pitch of effort. A military defeat is not the tombstone of national life. History affords innumerable examples to confirm the truth of that statement. Unfortunately, Germany's military overthrow was not an undeserved catastrophe, but a well-merited punishment which was in the nature of an eternal retribution. This defeat was more than deserved by us, for it represented the greatest external phenomenon of decomposition among a series of internal phenomena, which, although they were visible, were not recognized by the majority of the people, who follow the tactics of the ostrich and see only what they want to see.
File 49.
Let us examine the symptoms that were evident in Germany at the time that the German people accepted this defeat. Is it not true that in several circles the misfortunes of the fatherland were even joyfully welcomed in the most shameful manner? Who could act in such a way without thereby meriting vengeance for his attitude? Were there not people who went even further, and boasted that they had gone to the extent of weakening the front and causing a collapse? Therefore it was not the enemy who brought this disgrace upon our shoulders, but rather our own countrymen. If they suffered misfortune for it afterwards, was that misfortune undeserved? Was there ever a case in history where a people declared itself guilty of a war, and that even against the better conscience and its better knowledge? No, and again no. In the manner in which the German nation reacted to its defeat, we can see that the real cause of our collapse must be looked for elsewhere, and not in the purely military loss of a few positions or the failure of an offensive. For if the front as such had given way and thus brought about a national disaster, then the German nation would have accepted the defeat in quite another spirit. They would have borne the subsequent misfortune with clenched teeth, or they would have been overwhelmed by sorrow. Regret and fury would have filled their hearts against an enemy into whose hands victory had been given by a chance event or the decree of fate. And in that case, the nation, following the example of the Roman Senate, would have faced the defeated legions on their return and expressed their thanks for the sacrifices that had been made, and would have requested them not to lose faith in the empire. Even the capitulation would have been signed under the sway of calm reason, while the heart would have beaten in the hope of the coming revanche. That is the reception that would have been given to a military defeat, which had to be attributed only to the adverse decree of fortune. There would have been neither joy-making nor dancing. Cowardice would not have been boasted of, and the defeat would not have been honoured. On returning from the front, the troops would not have been mocked at, and the colours would not have been dragged in the dust. But above all, that disgraceful state of affairs could never have arisen which induced a British officer, Colonel Repington, to declare with scorn, "Every third German is a traitor." No, in such a case, this plague would never have assumed the proportions of a veritable flood, which, for the past 5 years, has smothered every vestige of respect for the German nation in the outside world. This shows only too clearly how false it is to say that the loss of the war was the cause of the German breakup. No, the military defeat was itself but the consequence of a whole series of morbid symptoms and their causes, which had become active in the German nation before the war broke out. The war was the first catastrophic consequence, visible to all, of how traditions and national morale had been poisoned, and how the instinct of self-preservation had degenerated. These were the preliminary causes which for many years had been undermining the foundations of the nation and the empire. But it remained for the Jews, with their unqualified capacity for falsehood, and their fighting comrades, the Marxists, to impute responsibility for the downfall precisely to the man who alone had shown a superhuman will and energy in his effort to prevent the catastrophe which he had foreseen, and to save the nation from that hour of complete overthrow and shame. By placing responsibility for the loss of the World War on the shoulders of Ludendorff, they took away the weapon of moral right from the only adversary dangerous enough to be likely to succeed in bringing the betrayers of the fatherland to justice. All this was inspired by the principle, which is quite true in itself, that in the big lie there is always a certain force of credibility, because the broad masses of a nation are always more easily corrupted in the deeper strata of their emotional nature than consciously or voluntarily. And thus, in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more readily fall victims to the big lie than the small lie, since they themselves often tell small lies in little matters, but would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe that others could have the same impudence to distort the truth so infamously. Even though the facts which prove this to be so may be brought clearly to their minds, they will still doubt and waver, and will continue to think that there may be some other explanation. For the grossly impudent lie always leaves traces behind, even after it has been nailed down, a fact which is known to all expert liars in this world, and to all who conspire together in the art of lying. These people know only too well how to use falsehood for the basest purposes. From time immemorial, however, the Jews have known better than any others how falsehood and calumny can be exploited. Is not their very existence founded on one great lie, namely that they are a religious community, whereas in reality they are a race? And what a race! One of the greatest thinkers that mankind has produced has branded the Jews for all time with a statement which is profoundly and exactly true. He, Schopenhauer, called the Jew the great master of lies. Those who do not realize the truth of that statement, or do not wish to believe it, will never be able to lend a hand in helping truth to prevail. We may regard it as a great stroke of fortune for the German nation that its period of lingering suffering was so suddenly curtailed and transformed into such a terrible catastrophe, for if things had gone on as they were, the nation would have more slowly but more surely gone to ruin. The disease would have become chronic, whereas in the acute form of the disaster, it at least showed itself clearly to the eyes of a considerable number of observers. It was not by accident that man conquered the black plague more easily than he conquered tuberculosis. The first appeared in terrifying waves of death that shook the whole of mankind. The other advances insidiously. The first induces terror. The other, gradual indifference. The result is, however, that men opposed the first with all the energy they were capable of, whilst they try to arrest tuberculosis by feeble means. Thus man has mastered the Black Plague, while tuberculosis still gets the better of him. The same applies to diseases in nations. So long as these diseases are not of a catastrophic character, the population will slowly accustom itself to them and later succumb. It is then a stroke of luck, although a bitter one, when fate decides to interfere in this slow process of decay and suddenly brings the victim face to face with the final stage of the disease. More often than not, the result of the catastrophe is that a cure is at once undertaken and carried through with rigid determination. But even in such a case, the essential preliminary condition is always the recognition of the internal causes which have given rise to the disease in question. The important question here is the differentiation of the root causes from the circumstances developing out of them. This becomes all the more difficult the longer the germs of the disease remain in the national body, and the longer they are allowed to become an integral part of that body. It may easily happen that, as time goes on, it will become so difficult to recognize certain definite virulent poisons as such that they are accepted as belonging to the national being. Or they are merely tolerated as a necessary evil, so that drastic attempts to locate those alien germs are not held to be necessary. During the long period of peace prior to the last war, certain evils were apparent here and there, although, with one or two exceptions, very little effort was made to discover their origin. Here again, these exceptions were first and foremost those phenomena in the economic life of the nation which were more apparent to the individual than the evil conditions existing in a good many other spheres. There were many signs of decay which ought to have been given serious thought. As far as economics were concerned, the following may be said. The amazing increase of population in Germany before the war brought the question of providing daily bread into a more and more prominent position in all spheres of political and economic thought and action. But unfortunately, those responsible could not make up their minds to arrive at the only correct solution, and preferred to reach their objective by cheaper methods. Repudiation of the idea of acquiring fresh territory, and the substitution for it of the mad desire for the commercial conquest of the world, was bound to lead eventually to unlimited and injurious industrialization. The first and most fatal result brought about in this way was the weakening of the agricultural classes, whose decline was proportionate to the increase in the proletariat of the urban areas, until finally the equilibrium was completely upset. The big barrier dividing rich and poor now became apparent. Luxury and poverty lived so close to each other that the consequences were bound to be deplorable. Want and frequent unemployment began to play havoc with the people and left discontent and embitterment behind them. The result of this was to divide the population into political classes. Discontent increased in spite of commercial prosperity. Matters finally reached that stage which brought about the general conviction that things cannot go on as they are, although no one seemed able to visualize what was really going to happen. These were typical and visible signs of the depths which the prevailing discontent had reached. Far worse than these, however, were other consequences which became apparent as a result of the industrialization of the nation. In proportion to the extent that commerce assumed definite control of the state, money became more and more of a god, whom all had to serve and bow down to. Heavenly gods became more and more old-fashioned, and were laid away in the corners to make room for the worship of Mammon. And thus began a period of utter degeneration, which became specially pernicious because it set in at a time when the nation was more than ever in need of an exalted idea, for a critical hour was threatening. Germany should have been prepared to protect with the sword her efforts to win her own daily bread in a peaceful way. Unfortunately, the predominance of money received support and sanction in the very quarter which ought to have been opposed to it. His Majesty the Kaiser made a mistake when he raised representatives of the new finance capital to the ranks of the nobility. Admittedly, it may be offered as an excuse that even Bismarck failed to realize the threatening danger in this respect. In practice, however, all ideal virtues became secondary considerations to those of money, for it was clear that having once taken this road, the nobility of the sword would very soon rank second to that of finance. Financial operations succeed easier than war operations. Hence it was no longer any great attraction for a true hero or even a statesman to be brought into touch with the nearest Jew banker. Real merit was not interested in receiving cheap decorations, and therefore declined them with thanks. But from the standpoint of good breeding, such a development was deeply regrettable. The nobility began to lose more and more of the racial qualities that were a condition of its very existence, with the result that in many cases the term plebeian would have been more appropriate.
50.
A serious state of economic disruption was being brought about by the slow elimination of the personal control of vested interests and the gradual transference of the whole economic structure into the hands of joint stock companies. In this way, labour became degraded into an object of speculation in the hands of unscrupulous exploiters. The depersonalization of property ownership increased on a vast scale. Financial exchange circles began to triumph and made slow but sure progress in assuming control of the whole of national life. Before the war, the internationalization of the German economic structure had already begun by the roundabout way of share issues. It is true that a section of the German industrialists made a determined effort to avert the danger, but in the end they gave way before the united attacks of money-grabbing capitalism, which was assisted in this fight by its faithful henchmen in the Marxist movement. The persistent war against German heavy industries was the visible start of the internationalization of German economic life as envisaged by the Marxists. This, however, could only be brought to a successful conclusion by the victory which Marxism was able to gain in the revolution. As I write these words, success is attending the general attack on the German state railways, which are now to be turned over to international capitalists. Thus, international social democracy has once again attained one of its main objectives. The best evidence of how far this commercialization of the German nation was able to go can be plainly seen in the fact that when the war was over, one of the leading captains of German industry and commerce gave it as his opinion that commerce as such was the only force which could put Germany on its feet again. This sort of nonsense was uttered just at the time when France was restoring public education on a humanitarian basis, thus doing away with the idea that national life is dependent on commerce rather than ideal values. The statement which Stinnes broadcast to the world at that time caused incredible confusion. It was immediately taken up and has become the leading motto of all those humbugs and babblers, the statesmen whom fate let loose on Germany after the revolution. One of the worst evidences of decadence in Germany before the war was the ever-increasing habit of doing things by halves. This was one of the consequences of the insecurity that was felt all round, and it is to be attributed also to a certain timidity which resulted from one cause or another. And the latter malady was aggravated by the educational system. German education in pre-war times had an extraordinary number of weak features. It was simply and exclusively limited to the production of pure knowledge, and paid little attention to the development of practical ability. Still less attention was given to the development of individual character, insofar as this is ever possible, and hardly any attention at all was paid to the development of a sense of responsibility, to strengthening the will and the powers of decision. The result of this method was to produce erudite people who had a passion for knowing everything. Before the war, we Germans were accepted and estimated accordingly. The German was liked, because good use could be made of him. But there was little esteem for him personally, on account of this weakness of character. For those who can read its significance aright, there is much instruction in the fact that among all nationalities, Germans were the first to part with their national citizenship when they found themselves in a foreign country. And there is a world of meaning in the saying that was then prevalent: with the hat in the hand, one can go through the whole country. This kind of social etiquette turned out disastrous when it prescribed the exclusive forms that had to be observed in the presence of His Majesty. These forms insisted that there should be no contradiction whatsoever, but that everything should be praised which His Majesty condescended to like. It was just here that the frank expression of manly dignity, and not subservience, was most needed. Civility in the presence of monarchs may be good enough for the professional lackey and place-hunter. In fact, for all those decadent beings who are more pleased to be found moving in the high circles of royalty than among honest citizens. These exceedingly humble creatures, however, though they grovel before their lord and bread-giver, invariably put on airs of boundless superciliousness towards other mortals, which was particularly impudent when they posed as the only people who had the right to be called monarchists. This was a gross piece of impertinence, such as only despicable specimens among the newly ennobled or yet to be ennobled could be capable of. And these have always been just the people who have prepared the way for the downfall of monarchy and the monarchical principle. It could not be otherwise. For when a man is prepared to stand up for a cause, come what may, he never grovels before its representative. A man who is serious about the maintenance and welfare of an institution will not allow himself to be discouraged when the representatives of that institution show certain faults and failings, and he certainly will not run around to tell the world about it, as certain false democratic friends of the monarchy have done. But he will approach His Majesty, the bearer of the crown himself, to warn him of the seriousness of a situation, and persuade the monarch to act. Furthermore, he will not take up the standpoint that it must be left to His Majesty to act as the latter thinks fit, even though the course which he would take must plainly lead to disaster. But the man I am thinking of will deem it his duty to protect the monarchy against the monarch himself, no matter what personal risk he may run in doing so. If the worth of the monarchical institution be dependent on the person of the monarch himself, then it would be the worst institution imaginable, for only in rare cases are kings found to be models of wisdom and understanding and integrity of character, though we might like to think otherwise. But this fact is unpalatable to the professional knaves and lackeys. Yet all upright men, and they are the backbone of the nation, repudiate the nonsensical fiction that all monarchs are wise, etc. For such men, history is history, and truth is truth, even where monarchs are concerned. But if a nation should have the good luck to possess a great king or a great man, it ought to consider itself as specially favoured above all the other nations, and these may be thankful if an adverse fortune has not allotted the worst to them. It is clear that the worth and significance of the monarchical principle cannot rest in the person of the monarch alone, unless heaven decrees that the crown should be set on the head of a brilliant hero, like Frederick the Great, or a sagacious person like William the First. This may happen once in several centuries, but hardly oftener than that. The ideal of the monarchy takes precedence of the person of the monarch, inasmuch as the meaning of the institution must lie in the institution itself. Thus, the monarchy may be reckoned in the category of those whose duty it is to serve. He, too, is but a wheel in this machine, and as such, he is obliged to do his duty towards it. He has to adapt himself for the fulfilment of high aims. If, therefore, there were no significance attached to the idea itself, and everything merely centred around the sacred person, then it would never be possible to depose a ruler who has shown himself to be an imbecile. It is essential to insist upon this truth at the present time, because recently those phenomena have appeared again, and were in no small measure responsible for the collapse of the monarchy. With a certain amount of native impudence, these persons once again talk about their king, that is to say, the man whom they shamefully deserted a few years ago at a most critical hour. Those who refrain from participating in this chorus of lies are summarily classed as bad Germans. They who make the change are the same class of quitters who ran away in 1918 and took to wearing red badges. They thought that discretion was the better part of valour. They were indifferent about what happened to the Kaiser. They camouflaged themselves as peaceful citizens, but more often than not they vanished altogether. All of a sudden, these champions of royalty were nowhere to be found at that time. Circumspectly, one by one, these servants and counsellors of the crown reappeared to resume their lip service to royalty, but only after others that had borne the brunt of the anti-royalist attack and suppressed the revolution for them. Once again they were all there, remembering wistfully the flesh-pots of Egypt and almost bursting with devotion for the royal cause. This went on until the day came when red badges were again in the ascendant. Then this whole ramshackle assembly of royal worshippers scuttled anew like mice from the cats. If monarchs were not themselves responsible for such things, one could not help sympathizing with them. But they must realize that with such champions, thrones can be lost, but certainly never gained.
File 51.
All this devotion was a mistake, and was the result of our whole system of education, which in this case brought about a particularly severe retribution. Such lamentable trumpery was kept up at the various courts that the monarchy was slowly becoming undermined. When, finally, it did begin to totter, everything was swept away. Naturally, grovellers and lickspittles are never willing to die for their masters. That monarchs never realize this, and almost on principle never really take the trouble to learn it, has always been their undoing. One visible result of wrong educational system was the fear of shouldering responsibility and the resultant weakness in dealing with obvious and vital problems of existence. The starting point of this epidemic, however, was in our parliamentary institution, where the shirking of responsibility is particularly fostered. Unfortunately, the disease slowly spread to all branches of everyday life, but particularly affected the sphere of public affairs. Responsibility was being shirked everywhere, and this led to insufficient or half-hearted measures being taken, personal responsibility for each act being reduced to a minimum. If we consider the attitude of various governments towards a whole series of really pernicious phenomena in public life, we shall at once recognize the fearful significance of this policy of half-measures and the lack of courage to undertake responsibilities. I shall single out only a few from the large numbers of instances known to me. In journalistic circles, it is a pleasing custom to speak of the press as a great power within the state. As a matter of fact, its importance is immense. One cannot easily overestimate it, for the press continues the work of education even in adult life. Generally, readers of the press can be classified into three groups. First, those who believe everything they read. Second, those who no longer believe anything. And third, those who critically examine what they read and form their judgments accordingly. Numerically, the first group is by far the strongest, being composed of the broad masses of the people. Intellectually, it forms the simplest portion of the nation. It cannot be classified according to occupation, but only into grades of intelligence. Under this category come all those who have not been born to think for themselves, or who have not learnt to do so, and who, partly through incompetence and partly through ignorance, believe everything that is set before them in print. To those we must add that type of lazy individual who, although capable of thinking for himself, out of sheer laziness gratefully absorbs everything that others had thought over, modestly believing this to have been thoroughly done. The influence which the press has on all these people is therefore enormous, for after all, they constitute the broad masses of a nation. But somehow they are not in a position or are not willing, personally, to sift what is being served up to them, so that their whole attitude towards daily problems is almost solely the result of extraneous influence. All this can be advantageous where public enlightenment is of a serious and truthful character, but great harm is done when scoundrels and liars take a hand at this work. The second group is numerically smaller, being partly composed of those who were formerly in the first group, and after a series of bitter disappointments, are now prepared to believe nothing of what they see in print. They hate all newspapers. Either they do not read them at all, or they become exceptionally annoyed at their contents, which they hold to be nothing but a congeries of lies and misstatements. These people are difficult to handle, for they will always be sceptical of the truth. Consequently, they are useless for any form of positive work. The third group is easily the smallest, being composed of real intellectuals, whom natural aptitude and education have taught to think for themselves, and who in all things try to form their own judgments, while at the same time carefully sifting what they read. They will not read any newspaper without using their own intelligence to collaborate with that of the writer, and naturally this does not set writers an easy task. Journalists appreciate this type of reader only with a certain amount of reservation. Hence the trash that newspapers are capable of serving up is of little danger, much less of importance, to the members of the third group of readers. In the majority of cases, these readers have learned to regard every journalist as fundamentally a rogue who sometimes speaks the truth. Most unfortunately, the value of these readers lies in their intelligence and not in their numerical strength. An unhappy state of affairs in a period where wisdom counts for nothing and majorities for everything. Nowadays, when the voting papers of the masses are the deciding factor, the decision lies in the hands of the numerically strongest group. That is to say, the first group, the crowd of simpletons and the credulous. It is an all-important interest of the state and a national duty to prevent these people from falling into the hands of false, ignorant, or even evil-minded teachers. Therefore, it is the duty of the state to supervise their education and prevent every form of offence in this respect. Particular attention should be paid to the press, for its influence on these people is by far the strongest and most penetrating of all, since its effect is not transitory, but continual. Its immense significance lies in the uniform and persistent repetition of its teaching. Here, if anywhere, the state should never forget that all means should converge towards the same end. It must not be led astray by the will-o'-the-wisp of so-called freedom of the press, or be talked into neglecting its duty and withholding from the nation that which is good and which does good. With ruthless determination, the state must keep control of this instrument of popular education and place it at the service of the state and the nation. But what sort of pabulum was it that the German press served up for the consumption of its readers in pre-war days? Was it not the most virulent poison imaginable? Was not pacifism in its worst form inoculated into our people at a time when others were preparing slowly but surely to pounce upon Germany? Did not this self-same press of ours in peacetime already instill into the public mind a doubt as to the sovereign rights of the state itself, thereby already handicapping the state in choosing its means of defence? Was it not the German press that understood how to make all the nonsensical talk about Western democracy palatable to our people, until an exuberant public was eventually prepared to entrust its future to the League of Nations? Was not this press instrumental in bringing in a state of moral degradation among our people? Were not morals and public decency made to look ridiculous, and classed as out of date and banal, until finally our people also became modernized? By means of persistent attacks, did not the press keep on undermining the authority of the state until one blow sufficed to bring this institution tottering to the ground? Did not the press oppose with all its might every movement to give the state that which belongs to the state, and by means of constant criticism injure the reputation of the army, sabotage general conscription, and demand refusal of military credits, etc., until the success of this campaign was assured? The function of the so-called liberal press was to dig the grave for the German people and Reich. No mention need be made of the lying Marxist press. To them the spreading of falsehood is as much a vital necessity as the mouse is to a cat. Their sole task is to break the national backbone of the people, thus preparing the nation to become the slaves of international finance and its masters, the Jews. And what measures did the state take to counteract this wholesale poisoning of the public mind? None. Absolutely nothing at all. By this policy it was hoped to win the favour of this pest, by means of flattery, by a recognition of the value of the press, its importance, its educative mission, and similar nonsense. The Jews acknowledged all this with a knowing smile and returned thanks. The reason for this ignominious failure on the part of the state lay not so much in its refusal to realize the danger as in the out-and-out cowardly way of meeting the situation by the adoption of faulty and ineffective measures. No one had the courage to employ any energetic and radical methods. Everyone temporized in some way or other, and instead of striking at its heart, the viper was only further irritated. The result was that not only did everything remain as it was, but the power of this institution which should have been combated grew greater from year to year. The defence put up by the government in those days against a mainly Jew-controlled press that was slowly corrupting the nation followed no definite line of action. It had no determination behind it, and above all no fixed objective whatsoever in view. This is where official understanding of the situation completely failed, both in estimating the importance of the struggle, choosing the means, and deciding on a definite plan. They merely tinkered with the problem. Occasionally, when bitten, they imprisoned one or another journalistic viper for a few weeks or months, but the whole poisonous brood was allowed to carry on in peace. It must be admitted that all this was partly the result of extraordinary crafty tactics on the part of Jewry on the one hand, and obvious official stupidity or naivety on the other hand. The Jews were too clever to allow a simultaneous attack to be made on the whole of their press. No. One section functioned as cover for the other. While the Marxist newspaper, in the most despicable manner possible, reviled everything that was sacred, furiously attacked the state and government, and incited certain classes of the community against each other, the bourgeois democratic papers, also in Jewish hands, knew how to camouflage themselves as model examples of objectivity. They studiously avoided harsh language, knowing well that blockheads are capable of judging only by external appearances, and never able to penetrate to the real depth and meaning of anything. They measure the worth of an object by its exterior, and not by its content. This form of human frailty was carefully studied and understood by the press.
File 52.
For this class of blockheads, the Frankfurter Zeitung would be acknowledged as the essence of respectability. It always carefully avoided calling a spade a spade. It deprecated the use of every form of physical force, and persistently appealed to the nobility of fighting with intellectual weapons. But this fight, curiously enough, was most popular with the least intellectual classes. That is one of the results of our defective education, which turns the youth away from the instinctive dictates of nature, pumps into them a certain amount of knowledge, without, however, being able to bring them to what is the supreme act of knowing. To this end, diligence and goodwill are of no avail, if innate understanding fail. This final knowledge at which man must aim is the understanding of causes which are instinctively perceived. Let me explain. Man must not fall into the error of thinking that he was ever meant to become lord and master of nature. A lopsided education has helped to encourage that illusion. Man must realize that a fundamental law of necessity reigns throughout the whole realm of nature, and that his existence is subject to the law of eternal struggle and strife. He will then feel that there cannot be a separate law for mankind in a world in which planets and suns follow their orbits, where moons and planets trace their destined path, where the strong are always the masters of the weak, and where those subject to such laws must obey them or be destroyed. Man must also submit to the eternal principles of this supreme wisdom. He may try to understand them, but he can never free himself from their sway. It is just for intellectual demi-monde that the Jew writes those papers which he calls his intellectual press. For them, the Frankfurter Zeitung and Berliner Tageblatt are written, the tone being adapted to them, and it is over these people that such papers have an influence. While studiously avoiding all forms of expression that might strike the reader as crude, the poison is injected from other vials into the hearts of the clientele. The effervescent tone and the fine phraseology lug the readers into believing that a love for knowledge and moral principle is the sole driving force that determines the policy of such papers, whereas, in reality, these features represent a cunning way of disarming any opposition that might be directed against the Jews and their press. They make such a parade of respectability that the imbecile readers are all the more ready to believe that the excesses which other papers indulge in are only of a mild nature and not such as to warrant legal action being taken against them. Indeed, such action might trespass on the freedom of the press, that expression being a euphemism under which such papers escape legal punishment for deceiving the public and poisoning the public mind. Hence, the authorities are very slow indeed to take any steps against these journalistic bandits, for fear of immediately alienating the sympathy of the so-called respectable press. A fear that is only too well founded, for the moment any attempt is made to proceed against any member of the gutter press, all the others rush to its assistance at once, not indeed to support its policy, but simply and solely to defend the principle of the freedom of the press and liberty of public opinion. This outcry will succeed in cowering the most stalwart, for it comes from the mouth of what is called decent journalism. And so this poison was allowed to enter the national bloodstream and infect public life without the government taking any effectual measures to master the course of the disease. The ridiculous half-measures that were taken were in themselves an indication of the process of disintegration that was already threatening to break up the empire. For an institution practically surrenders its existence when it is no longer determined to defend itself with all the weapons at its command. Every half-measure is the outward expression of an internal process of decay, which must lead to an external collapse, sooner or later. I believe that our present generation would easily master this danger if they were rightly led. For this generation has gone through certain experiences which must have strengthened the nerves of all those who did not become nervously broken by them. Certainly in days to come, the Jews will raise a tremendous cry throughout their newspapers once a hand is laid on their favourite nest, once a move is made to put an end to this scandalous press, and once this instrument which shapes public opinion is brought under state control and no longer left in the hands of aliens and enemies of the people. I am certain that this will be easier for us than it was for our fathers. The scream of the 12-inch shrapnel is more penetrating than the hiss from 1,000 Jewish newspaper vipers. Therefore, let them go on with their hissing. A further example of the weak and hesitating way in which vital national problems were dealt with in pre-war Germany is the following. Hand in hand with the political and moral process of infecting the nation, for many years an equally virulent process of infection had been attacking the public health of the people. In large cities particularly, syphilis steadily increased, and tuberculosis kept pace with it in reaping its harvest of death almost in every part of the country. Although in both cases the effect on the nation was alarming, it seemed as if nobody was in a position to undertake any decisive measures against these scourges. In the case of syphilis, especially, the attitude of the state and public bodies was one of absolute capitulation. To combat this state of affairs, something of far wider sweep should have been undertaken than was really done. The discovery of a remedy which is of a questionable nature, and the excellent way in which it was placed on the market, were only of little assistance in fighting such a scourge. Here again, the only course to adopt is to attack the disease in its causes rather than in its symptoms. But in this case, The primary cause is to be found in the manner in which love has been prostituted. Even though this did not directly bring about the fearful disease itself, the nation must still suffer serious damage thereby. For the moral havoc resulting from this